Sufferings, it's your boy Marty here to introduce this rip of TFTC. It was brought to you by our good friends at River, the best place to buy Bitcoin. River makes it very easy to buy Bitcoin, to sell Bitcoin. If you want to do that, you shouldn't sell it. They actually have a new thing at checkout if you're trying to sell Bitcoin. Michael Saylor comes out and says, are you sure you want to sell Bitcoin right now? Probably shouldn't. You should DCA into Bitcoin. River makes it very easy. You can set it and forget it by daily, weekly, monthly. If you DCA using River, you're not going to pay any fees on those buys. It's the easiest way to gift Bitcoin with River Link. You set an amount of Bitcoin you want to gift somebody. You create a link. You send that to somebody. You text it to them. You email it to them. You DM it to them. They click the link, and then they can sweep the Bitcoin to their River account or a wallet of their choice. It's a beautiful thing. River builds all their infrastructure in-house. They don't depend on third parties. It's the best place to buy Bitcoin. It's where we buy Bitcoin. Go to river.com/TFTC. Sign up today. You'll get $5 worth of Bitcoin. This rip was also brought to you by good friends down the hall, Unchained. Unchained is here to help you eliminate single points of failure in your custody model. Price of Bitcoin's going up. If you talked about owning Bitcoin publicly, you could be subjected to SIM swap attacks. Had a friend had this happen to him recently where he got SIM swapped attack. They went to go drain his exchanges, got past 2FA, all of that. Luckily, they didn't get his Bitcoin because he has his Bitcoin in an Unchained multisig vault, which keeps your keys offline, and they're always in cold storage. So you don't have to worry about somebody SIM swapping you and stealing your Bitcoin. Unchained also has an IRA product. If you have a retirement account and you want to get exposure to Bitcoin, get direct exposure. You don't have to buy the ETFs. You can actually hold the Bitcoin, take it in kind, as one should be able to do. Unchained makes that very easy. Go hit up Unchained's concierge team. Go to unchained.com/consultation. Learn about all their products, the vault, the IRA. They have a trading desk. They have a lending desk. They're doing it the right way. Unchained.com/consultation. Tell them that TFTC sent you. This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at Zaprite. If you're an individual out there who wants to accept Bitcoin as payment, Zaprite is the best way to do that. Go to zaprite.com/TFTC, set up an account, and Zaprite makes it very easy to connect your own wallets. They're wallet agnostic. You simply enter an XPub, connect your LND node, connect your Strike account, whatever it may be, and Zaprite handles the invoicing side of things. You can send invoices, payment links. They have a WooCommerce integration. So if you're a trucker, a rancher, a farmer, a doctor, a lawyer wants to accept Bitcoin as payment, go to Zaprite, connect your wallets, and start doing so today. The best part about Zaprite is they also accept fiat payments, so you don't have to have individual invoicing for people that pay in Bitcoin and people that pay in fiat. You do it all in one spot. You can connect Stripe, your ACH, and you send one invoice, and they can pay in fiat or Bitcoin. It's beautifully designed. They have they have dashboards, analytics, everything you need to hand over to your bookkeeper or your accountant. So again, go to zaprite.com/TFTC. Use the promo code TFTC at sign out, and you're going to get $40 off their annual subscription fee, which is typically $240. So with the code TFTC, you drop that down to $200. Zaprite.com/TFTC. Last but not least, this rip was brought to you by our good friends at Bitcoin Talent Co. Bull market's here. You may be looking to hire as your runway is extended because you have a bunch of Bitcoin on your corporate treasury. Go to Bitcoin Talent Co. It's a recruiting firm built by Bitcoiners for Bitcoiners. They understand Bitcoin multisig. They understand mining. They understand the Lightning Network, and they're highly competent recruiters. Andy, the co-founder, started Uber, grew their team from 100 to 10,000. He knows what he's doing. He knows how to go find the best talent in tech, design, banking, finance, whatever you need. They're going to understand your needs, and they're going to go get you the best talent to help us build out the Bitcoin standard. BitcoinTalent.co. Tell them the TFTC sent you and enjoy this rip.
Okay.
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Dennis Magan, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Marty. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Well, as we were saying before we hit record, I've been following you on Twitter for many years now. Inspiring individual, having really leaned into health and fitness later in your life. I think you tweeted last week, you're 69 years old. You're healthier than you were when you were 49, when you were 39. You're about the same age as Bill Gates, who does not look as healthy as you do.
Right. Yes, that's true. Yeah, Bill doesn't look so hot. Yeah.
He's very flappy. He's got a lot of extra skin, a lot of extra weight.
And, right. Absolutely. Yes.
And he's pushing health.
He is definitely. He's pushing a lot of health stuff. And I guess I could say in Bill's defense, he probably looks like the average 69-year-old man, and well, he's 68 still, the average 68-year-old man in this country. So yeah, that's about what 68-year-old men look like these days.
Well, these days is the most important thing. It wasn't always this way. How did we get so unhealthy as a nation? It's pretty disconcerting to look out and see how fat we've become.
Absolutely. And you know, depending on who you ask, you're going to get a lot of different answers to this. But I think in my opinion, the easiest answer is it's junk food. This is just, you know, increased massively in availability and supply in this country over the last few decades. And really, that's what's doing it for the most part. And then, you know, you could get into, you know, what are the ingredients, what specific things are doing it. But junk food contains a lot of refined grains, sugar, and seed oils. So those are the three main things. And, you know, you can get into things like people are more able to afford it. There's fast food everywhere. People are eating out all the time. This sort of thing. I mean, when I was young, very little of that existed. Going out to a restaurant was a big deal. We didn't do it all that often. So that's what I think's going on.
Yeah. It's the seed oils thing has been a very big thing, particularly within the Bitcoin community. In recent years, it seems like people have really honed on to seed oils as a root of a lot of these issues, just one of many roots. I know my wife has maniacally been trying to root seed oils out of our diet and has really leaned into trying to cook as much as possible from home for us and our boys. And I think it has had a profound impact on our overall health.
Absolutely. Yeah, the seed oils thing, it's bad. I mean, it you know, I advise my clients to avoid the stuff entirely, if at all possible. And just eating at home is a big deal as much as possible. Eating out, you just end up eating massive amounts of generally bad food. So, that'll have a big impact.
And does it all come back to metabolism? And I know you have a strong focus on metabolic health. And
well, I'm not sure. It depends on exactly what you mean by that. I'm not sure that metabolism per se is so important in the obesity epidemic, in people being overweight. The reason being is that no matter how many calories you burn, that it's almost always possible to eat plenty more than you burn. This is why exercise is generally ineffective for weight loss. People exercise and they burn calories, but exercise doesn't burn all that many calories. And then if you don't get your diet right, it's very easy to eat more than you burn. And especially if you're eating junk food that's, has all the refined grains and sugar and seed oils, it's totally possible to burn more. So metabolism, definitely metabolic health is huge. What comes first is whether it's poor metabolic health or obesity is a good question. But certainly the two go together. So as far as metabolic health goes, it's just behind everything that's going on. You know, epidemics of heart disease and cancer and diabetes and so on, they are all connected, definitely.
Yeah. And that's one thing that I find really interesting with what you're doing on the advising side of how people should get back in shape. It's really leaning into, like, you got to work out smartly. I couldn't think of a good word. You got to do it. You got to have a very good plan, but you can do a lot. You can do a lot for your health with very, not very little, but with targeted, calculated workouts. It's not as insane or as burdensome in terms of getting to the gym every day. I believe that you think you can get your metabolic health back in line on the fitness side of things with very few workouts a week, which I like to hear.
Absolutely. Intensity of exercise trumps volume. So if you work out with sufficient intensity, you just don't need as much volume of exercise or as much frequency of exercise. So for example, myself, I exercise about an hour a week. Now we've got to say that, you know, what am I calling exercise here? I'm calling exercise structured physical activity that is intense, that is designed to improve your fitness. So I'm when I say exercise, I'm not just talking about physical activity, like going out for a walk or, you know, playing tennis or whatever somebody might do. Physical activity is, of course, important. It's a very good idea to be physically active daily. But as far as exercise goes, exercise to improve your fitness, if it's done with sufficient intensity, it doesn't need to take a long time. The problem is most people are not exercising with sufficient intensity. This is something that I see in my own gym where I go. I see a lot of people sort of casually moving weights around, not really basically putting their soul into the workout. So that is what is necessary to improve fitness if you want to do it in just a couple of 30-minute sessions a week.
What is that like a HIIT workout, like high intensity?
It is very similar. So this is what I do, is high intensity resistance training. So what this involves is doing basically mostly compound exercises. So, you know, what you might call the big exercises, things like deadlifts and leg press and overhead press and this kind of thing. It involves going to failure. In other words, you're going to do reps on these exercises until you cannot move that weight or resistance anymore. And that requires, well, when you get to that point, it is very intense. The tendency of many people is to stop when they get to the point of maximum tolerable discomfort. And it does get very uncomfortable, but that is not necessarily the same thing as really going to failure. So it is definitely a very intense process. If done properly, in other words, by properly, I mean doing mostly the big compound exercises and using minimal rest between exercises, then this also becomes a cardiovascular workout. So I get my heart rate quite elevated during these workouts. So it basically, you could say it doubles as both strength training and a workout to improve cardiovascular fitness.
This is something I'd love to hear because I hate running, and I never liked the idea of running, going on 2-mile, 5-mile long runs to lose weight.
in my opinion, there's a false dichotomy between endurance training and strength training. Strength training, if done properly, does improve cardiovascular fitness. And especially if it's done intensely and, you know, in a high intensity way, it definitely improves cardiovascular fitness. There's been all kinds of, recent research. By recent, I mean, over the last, say, 10 to 15 years, showing that high intensity training improves cardiovascular fitness as much as medium intensity continuous training does, only in a lot less time. So yeah, if done properly, you can both build muscle and improve your cardiovascular fitness at the same time in a relatively short amount of time. Huh.
And why do you think it's so hard for people to get to the point of even like getting to the gym and doing things? So we were talking before we hit record, one thing I want to talk about is the, obviously, the Bill Gates of the world who are pushing things like lab-produced meat that is quote-unquote healthier for you. There's a really big focus on diet. Cutting seed oils which certainly helps, but obviously exercise is one big part of it. But people seem to want to completely neglect that and find super drugs like Ozempic, which is being marketed. What is it, Ozempic and Wegovy or...
Right. There's several different drugs that, and different brand names, but yeah, Ozempic is, I think, marketed for diabetics, and then they've got Wegovy, which I think is the same thing, only it's marketed for weight loss. Yeah.
And these things essentially just, from what I understand, the research I've done, like I was telling you, I've had some family members approach me and be like, oh, I'm thinking about taking Ozempic. And I'm like, oh, let me look into this. And it just paralyzes your stomach and lets stuff build. So it's just basically your stomach isn't processing like it normally would. So you don't get hungry. So you don't eat.
Well, certainly, you know, that stomach paralysis thing, I guess we could probably describe it as a side effect, but the real effect of these weight loss drugs is they make people less hungry. And so what happens is that if people are eating less, let me back up just a bit. So you may have seen that in some of these studies, they found that up to 40% of the weight loss that people experience on these drugs is muscle. And that's really bad. So if people lose weight and they don't do strength training and they don't get adequate protein, then they can lose muscle as part of the weight they lose. So you see this with extreme dieting, like extreme calorie restriction and people doing tons of cardio, this sort of thing, like in that show that was on, I think, a few years ago, The Biggest Loser, where these basically sort of boot camp type crash diets and a lot of cardio. So what happens with these weight loss drugs is basically people are just eating the same junk they ate before, only less of it. So they're not getting enough protein because they weren't before, and now they're eating a lot less. So they're just not getting adequate protein, and I have little doubt that very few of them are doing strength training. So these people lose muscle as part of the weight they lose, and that's bad. It's bad for metabolic health. Muscle is a very important organ for metabolic health. Generally speaking, the more muscle you have, the better your metabolic health. Now, why are people doing this? For one thing, the advice they're getting, the mainstream weight loss advice that they're getting is terrible. So the mainstream weight loss advice is basically eat less and move more. If that worked, we wouldn't have a we wouldn't have an obesity problem. But it doesn't work because it doesn't take hunger into account. People, one of the reasons people are eating too much is because they're hungry. The way that people eat is making them hungry, or it's making them more hungry than they need to be. It's not, the way they are eating is not satiating. So the advice they're getting is terrible. There's another aspect of it too, and that is that people don't want to give up certain things. So people don't want to be told that, don't eat pizza, for example, don't eat donuts. A lot of people just won't do this. So there's two aspects of it, basically from the healthcare side and from the patient side, that is driving the huge use of these drugs. From the patient side also, plenty of these people have no doubt tried to lose weight before. And they know that the advice they're getting from the mainstream doesn't work, or it's too painful. You know, they think they've got to starve themselves and so on. So maybe understandably, they're not willing to do that. So then they go for these drugs.
Yeah. It's the cheap way out, if you want. It really drives home that there's no easy way. You got to do proof of work to actually get good results, because that's the one thing that worries me about this. Like, these Ozempic and its competitors are being pushed on the market as this magic shot that you can take once a month and have insane results. But from what I understand, again, it creates that paralysis of the stomach, which can build up. You can have like a septic backup in your own body. And I've heard stories of people dying from literally choking on their own shit. And then on top of that, if you do stop, the weight comes back pretty rapidly, which is not healthy
right,
at all.
Right. So if people don't learn how to eat properly and how to exercise properly, and they're not going to learn if they listen to mainstream healthcare, then yeah, they when they stop using these drugs, then the weight comes back. That's definitely been shown. So for many people, these are going to be lifelong drugs that they're going to have to use their entire lives unless they figure it out on their own. Otherwise, they're just going to regain the weight. And then we don't know what the long-term side effects are. So you mentioned like this stomach paralysis. So I guess we could say that's more or less a short-term side effect, because people are experiencing this already. But longer-term side effects could conceivably be even worse. I've seen some indications that it could increase cancer risk and this kind of thing. So that's obviously not good.
No, not at all. And you mentioned something earlier about controlling your hunger and making sure you eat to the point of satiation. And I guess what you're getting at is there's a good type of hunger and a bad type of hunger that we should be focused on.
Well, I think the way to look at this is, you think, why do people gain weight and why do they have so much trouble losing it? They gain weight because they eat more than they need, because they are hungry. They experience hunger more than people who are eating in a correct way, or people who are not overweight. So getting that hunger under control is key for getting the weight under control. And so what happens is various physiological things happen, like increased insulin that prevents people from accessing their fat stores for energy. And then their brain experiences hunger, and so then they eat more. So that is what is going on. In my opinion, what people should do is be eating in such a way that they don't experience this kind of hunger. So if you eat in certain ways, you just don't get as hungry as often. But most people don't know this. Certainly mainstream healthcare doesn't know this. And so this is why people have so much difficulty losing weight. So it's not a matter of like one kind of hunger versus another kind of hunger. It's not a matter of being able to withstand hunger. It's a matter of eating in such a way that you just don't experience as much hunger as somebody who's eating in a wrong way.
Uh-huh. When you say eating like the right way, is it a mixture of like the what and how, meaning like what you eat, obviously the protein and the calories that you put in your body, but then how, like obviously intermittent fasting has been a big trend over the last decade. Sort of breaking up your meals into smaller chunks or one large chunk. Like how much does that play into it? Or is it simply just what you eat and how much of it?
It's more about what you eat, in my opinion. So intermittent fasting is definitely a good thing. It helps a lot of people lose weight and it definitely has health benefits, but it's more a matter of eating in such a way that you experience less hunger. Let me give you an example. If you had steak and eggs for breakfast versus a calorically equal amount of Cheerios and milk, who is going to get hungry again the fastest? Well, I think it's pretty obvious that the person who eats the Cheerios is, you know, by noon, they're going to be starving. They're going to be famished. And so they need to eat a big meal or, you know, anyway, they need to eat. The person who eats steak and eggs is just simply not going to be as hungry at noon. Maybe not hungry at all. Maybe even able to skip it. So it's more about what you eat, in my opinion.
Yeah. And why is that in this particular case? Is it the carbs and the Cheerios? Is it true what they say, carbs make you hungrier?
Carbs definitely make you hungrier, and protein makes you less hungry. All animals, including humans, have a drive for protein. And so we will eat more until we satisfy this drive for protein. So if you're eating low protein foods, then you need to eat more to satisfy your hunger, whether it's over the short term, over the longer term. So you could say that one of the things that drove the obesity epidemic is the fact that people were told starting about the time the obesity epidemic got going that they shouldn't eat so much meat because it was bad for you. All that saturated fat and everything is going to cause heart disease, this kind of thing. And so then they're eating a lot of low protein foods. And then so they're hungrier. So they switched from eating a lot of higher protein foods, or at least including them, these higher protein foods like meat and eggs in their diet, to eating a lot of higher carb, low protein foods. And so this drives hunger. And this is, in my opinion, certainly a factor in the obesity epidemic.
Yeah. Meat's bad for you. It's not only really bad for you, it's bad for the environment. All those cows are farting and burping, releasing methane right into the atmosphere. We can't eat meat. It's bad for you, and it's going to destroy the environment, which I wonder if the latter narrative is a pivot now that more people are coming to understand that meat and protein may not be as bad for you. They're actually essential to being able to flourish as an individual. And that's the other thing, like the cholesterol. I saw you were tweeting about LDL cholesterol. I think that was a big data point that people who are trying to push the meat is bad for you meme were pointing at is cholesterol. High cholesterol is bad for your health. And from what I understand, there's nuances to types of cholesterol and where their levels can be compared to each other.
Sure. The thing is, well, number one, I don't buy the cholesterol causing heart disease argument. But the other thing is that even if you did accept that, cholesterol in the diet does not raise blood cholesterol. So saturated fat does to some extent. But yeah, that's one of the things that, you know, that, oh, they, you know, eating this saturated fat raises your cholesterol and therefore you shouldn't eat as much of it. And, you know, yeah, most people believe that. It's widely accepted, wrong in my opinion, but there it is.
Why is it wrong in your opinion?
There are all kinds of studies that show that cholesterol is not related to heart disease, that this is a vast area, of course. But for example, older people with higher LDL cholesterol live longer than people with lower LDL cholesterol. There are a number of studies that show that LDL cholesterol that is currently higher than the accepted recommendations is actually the healthiest, that people with these higher LDL cholesterol levels have lower mortality rates. There are, you know, things like people admitted to the hospital with heart attacks, half of them have normal cholesterol levels. So this is a vast field, but I think the evidence points to the fact that cholesterol does not cause coronary heart disease.
Yeah. It's the studies are a double-edged sword because you can get good information like this, and then, but there's also the studies that push people away from protein. How much do you think the research side and the jockeying to get papers published in academic medical journals has corrupted the health industry, for lack of a better term?
Well, yeah, that there's a lot to unpack there. A lot of studies are funded by drug companies, for one thing. So drug companies obviously want to sell their products. So they want to show that their products are wonderful, that they improve health and so on. A lot of the doctors that do these studies and that recommend these drugs are, they've received money from Big Pharma and so on. Then there's also the issue of whether when you publish something in a journal, some things are acceptable and some are not. Peer review is, you know, part of the function of peer review is to keep non-mainstream ideas out of the literature. So yes, you know, if you go into and read the literature, sure, you can find sides that support almost anything you want, really.
Yeah. And that's where it comes down to, again, proof of work and just like looking at you, 69 years old, look extremely healthy, you're pretty jacked. And that's what I've come to really fall back on. It's like, all right, here's all these studies. People tell me this is healthy, this is unhealthy, but what do they actually look like? Again, like going back to Bill Gates as a perfect example of this archetype of an individual that thinks he can solve all the world's problems, particularly from a health perspective, with a shot or genetically modified food, whatever it may be. And then you look at the guy and you're like, I don't know if I should be taking medical and health advice from you personally.
Right. Right. Yeah. There's plenty of doctors now are overweight and, you wonder, well, if these doctors are overweight, you could look at it too, in a couple of different ways. One is they don't know how to be normal weight. They don't know how to lose weight. So if they don't know how, then, you know, how are they going to properly tell patients to lose weight? The other thing is you could say, well, maybe doctors don't care or something like that. Maybe individual doctors don't care enough to lose weight. But I think the fact that doctors are generally such high achievers. It takes them years to get through college, then medical school, then internships. They, you know, they work long hours, all this kind of stuff. They have a lot of drive. And so then, but then they don't have the drive to lose weight. That doesn't really make sense. When I suggested this once on Twitter, someone said to me, well, yeah, doctors work long hours. They're so busy. They don't have time. Well, as we were talking about with the training, it doesn't take a lot of time. It's way more about what you eat than how much or what kind of exercise you do. So the time excuse does not ring true to me. I don't recommend it, but plenty of people do lose weight without exercise. So it's all about the food.
Quick break here, freaks. This rip is brought to you by Gradually Then Suddenly, a framework for understanding Bitcoin as money by Parker Lewis. I wrote the foreword to the book. I'm honored to have done so because it's the best 0-to-1 primer if you're looking for a logical explanation of why Bitcoin obsoletes all other money. Buy one for yourself and maybe a few for your friends. Go to thesafehouse.com/gradually. That's thesafehouse.com, safe spelled S-A-I-F, thesafehouse.com/gradually. Use the promo code TFTC for $5 off at checkout. Buy it now, freaks. The price of Bitcoin is going up. You need to understand it. This is the best 0-to-1 primer. Back to the show.
And it's so what can, I mean, just really help people who are listening to this and maybe in a situation where they're unhealthy and maybe they're in their 40s or 50s or 60s. They're like, oh, it's too late for me. Like I should, I've already sort of pot committed myself to living life the way it is. Like what argument would you put forth for people, particularly of an older age, to get in shape? Like how long can it extend your life?
That's definitely not true. It's never too late. And getting into decent shape, I mean, depending on the starting point, doesn't necessarily take all that long. Yeah. If somebody has a lot of weight to lose, 100 pounds, let's say, or something like that, sure, they're not going to take it off overnight. But plenty of people do that in the course of a year or two. And so it's totally possible. As far as the exercise goes, like I've said, it doesn't take all that long and people can get into shape. People can put on muscle even when they're elderly. There's been at least one study showing that people in their 80s and 90s can put on muscle if they do resistance training, and they can improve their VO2 max, that is their exercise capacity. So it is never too late. A lot of health problems can be either reversed or significantly mitigated in a pretty short length of time. So it's just not the case that it's too late for somebody. I mean, unless they've developed some kind of problem that is just, you know, beyond the point of solving. But for most people, even then, if they've developed some kind of problem that's, you know, some kind of bad health problem, getting proper diet and exercise is definitely going to help.
Yeah. You think about particularly for people who are older too. It's like if you want to enjoy retirement age, like you should probably be healthy, right? Like you don't want to work your whole life and get to a point where it's like, oh, I can actually enjoy the fruits of my labor after decades of hard work. And you get there and you're like, oh, fuck, I can't even walk down the street.
Right. I think the real problem with someone like that is the fact that if they've gone their whole life without taking care of their health, without caring about it, they got to change a lot. It's psychological. They have to change a lot of habits. They have to start caring about their health. This does happen for many people when they have some kind of a health scare. All of a sudden, boom, okay, now I see what my priorities are. For many other people, though, even with the health scare, even with deteriorating health, they just won't change. This is, unfortunately, surprisingly common that people won't change even when faced with a massive health problem. Another thing is that many people, and including their doctors, don't believe that what they eat has a profound effect on their health, which it does. So they don't think that changing what they eat is going to make a lot of difference. So it does become harder when somebody gets older to make those changes. The changes, if made, can be very effective, but people have to want to do it.
Yeah. And you've worked with hundreds of people, of individuals, to help coach them get back in the good shape. What's the most common denominator that you find of an unlock for individuals who thought maybe it would be harder than it actually was? What do you see across your clients?
Yeah. So most people, I find, still think that they need to exercise their excess body fat away. This is what seemingly, I see this among my clients that come to me. I see a lot of them think that at the beginning. And so I have to assume that this is what most of the public thinks, that they're going to exercise away their body fat. Certainly what I see in the gym that I go to, this appears to be the case. A lot of people seem to be there to lose weight. I see people with excess weight to lose laboring away on those treadmills or the stationary cycles and so on. And that's just not going to do it. You have to change what you eat. So I would say among my clients, that's a big thing, is realizing that while you should exercise, you should do proper strength training while losing weight, and even when not losing weight, of course, too. But it's extra important when you're losing weight to retain your muscle. Getting your diet right is going to be the most important thing. And so that's mainly what I coach my clients on, as far as getting their diet right, and then they're able to successfully lose weight when they've had so many problems before. And this is even among people who had thought that they were doing the right thing. So, you know, as you've seen me on Twitter and everything, I have a lot of followers, and plenty of these people follow other, for lack of a better term, diet gurus or health gurus or something like that. And they think they're doing the right thing. But a lot of it, a lot of what is being preached out there as far as weight loss is not the right thing. And so when I can get them on the right track, then they can go on successfully lose weight.
What are some of the most common misconceptions, or what's the most common bad advice that these diet gurus are giving?
Well, I guess it depends on where you're looking for this advice. There is a hell of a lot of bad advice out there, but let's just say that in my sort of neck of the woods, as far as what people who are similar in some ways to me are preaching, one of the big mistakes is consuming a lot of dietary fat. So you see this in low carb and ketogenic diet circles, where people are advised to cut carbohydrates. Cutting carbohydrates is certainly a decent idea. I eat pretty low in carbohydrates myself, but then they fill this up with things like, bulletproof coffee, or cooking everything in coconut oil, or this kind of thing. And they add a lot of fat to their diet, eating a lot of cheese, for example. This often prevents people from losing weight.
Yeah. Interesting. And when it comes to diet, is there like a cookie cutter diet that will work for everybody, or is it individualistic to an extent?
Yeah, that's a good question. Certainly, to an extent, it is individualistic. Yes, some people do better on some ways of eating than others. On the other hand, I like to say that, hey, we're all human beings. We're all the same species, and you know, you don't see lions, for example, eating different things. They all eat the same thing. While you can certainly experiment to see what might be more effective for some people, by and large, there are going to be a lot of similarities.
Yeah. Yeah. And is the go-to diet in your mind, it's like eggs, bacon? I see posts a lot about blueberries. Blueberries, good carbs.
Blueberries are good carbs. Yeah.
Yeah. That's why I'm like an eggs, bacon, steak, potatoes. Like, I'm Irish. I like my potatoes every once in a while. My boys eat a lot of blueberries, so I'll have a handful of blueberries a couple times a week.
Certainly, people could make, just speaking in the most general terms, if people didn't eat things that came in boxes and bags and the stuff that's sold in the middle aisles of the supermarket, processed foods, the kind of comes, you know, it has colorful labels, brand names, all this kind of stuff. And if they shopped around the perimeter and got the meat, eggs, fish, dairy, fruits, and vegetables, yeah, we wouldn't have nearly so much of a problem as we do now. Maybe not a problem at all.
Yeah. And it's a big problem. Is that right?
It is, and it's not getting any better. I mean, the obesity rate right now is around 40% of the population in the United States, and that does not include the people who are merely overweight. In other words, so if you combine overweight with obesity, you get about 80% of the population, and then another 10%. Or so are skinny fat. That is, they are of normal weight, but they're carrying too much body fat and not enough muscle. So you've got something on the order of 90% of the population that is either overweight, obese, or in otherwise poor metabolic health. This leads to greater risk of all kinds of diseases like heart disease and cancer and diabetes. So yeah, it's pretty much a health disaster. I got to say, I can't make that look too good, because it isn't very good.
No, like, has there ever been a society this unhealthy in human history?
Well, probably not. Not in terms of chronic disease. If you go back long enough, people were unhealthy. Yeah. I don't know if I want to say like how many of them or something, but people were unhealthy for different reasons. They were either malnourished, or they had infectious diseases, or they had acute problems, like, for example, trauma, wounds that got infected, or, you know, this kind of thing. So we've largely conquered that sort of thing. I mean, you know, if I broke my arm and went to a hospital, they're going to fix me up right away. They know what they're doing. It's great. But if I'm overweight or obese, now I'm, you know, I have metabolic syndrome or prediabetes or, you know, something, they really don't know what to do. It's other than prescribed drugs. So we've traded acute problems. We've fixed the acute problems, but we've traded them for chronic problems. So in terms of chronic disease, yeah, we're pretty much at the peak, I'd say, or if not at the peak, it's more than other societies have been. That's for sure.
Yeah. It feels like the food's the starting point of where this chronic disease stems from as well, because then you consider the fact that we're all in offices with fluorescent light. We're not getting direct sunlight exposure, which is extremely important to our overall health and well-being. All this stuff has downstream effects of higher depression rates and emotional problems that exacerbates the problem. And then we're just passing this on to the generations that are coming up now as well. And, I mean,
absolutely. There could be some very long-term effects that we don't even really know about yet. Epigenetic changes, definitely, as far as what you said about the getting sun exposure or light exposure. Yes, this is another thing that the healthcare system can take credit or blame for, because they've been telling us for the last several decades to stay out of the sun. And that's another piece of bad advice. So yeah, there's all these things, and then you get into other things that people think are significant factors, you know, blue light exposure, that sort of thing. Yeah, there's a lot of things going on. Definitely, we live in a pretty artificial state compared to the conditions that we evolved in. So yeah, fixing that. I want to say that it's easy enough for an individual to fix it. As a social problem, that's another matter altogether.
Does Bitcoin fix this?
Well, there's the whole thing about the longer time horizons, the time preference, and all that sort of thing. So I think maybe possibly one way that Bitcoin fixes it is basically the change in mindset, not only in time preference, but the fact that, well, you mentioned earlier about Bitcoiners being, you know, aware of the seed oil thing, right? Mm-hmm. So Bitcoiners, once you get the red pill on any aspect, you start seeing the red pill everywhere. So the red pill, of course, that expression comes from the movie The Matrix. I don't know if somebody else used it before, but in any case, you see it everywhere, whether it's the money, the food, whether it's, you know, relationships, it's formal education. It's just, you start seeing through everything. It can be very disconcerting, but seeing through things, or at least attempting to see the truth, is the first step in fixing them, in either socially or individually.
Yeah, I don't think directly giving somebody a Bitcoin address and sending Bitcoin to that is going to fix these problems. But again, like changing your perspective on time preference and how you approach life and longevity to life. I think when you get into like the food, the middle aisles of the grocery stores, or the pills that a lot of doctors are pushing, the magic pill that can save it, you're not going to have to do any hard work or proof of work. I think a lot of that is driven purely by profit motives that are fueled by easy money that make it easier for these companies to profit in a world that is completely disconnected from reality. And I think if you can change the incentives with sound money, you can begin to claw back, and people are somewhat forced by the market to live healthier lives, which I like to think is possible, because it is a big problem. It's something I think about a lot, especially with two young boys, thinking about what we feed them and what they get access to in terms of food, if they're at school or at a camp or whatever. It's like, holy crap, we're feeding our children. And that's going back to like long-term effects. Now that all this fiat food is pervasive, like, what does the long-term effect of introducing this crap into the human diet at such an early age do? Like, how does that change us?
I think it's important to note that, as far as you mentioned the fiat food, so, you know, we could call that the junk food, the fast food, whatever. You know, most people love this stuff. So you know, people love sugar. They love all the junk. They love pizza. They love donuts. They, whatever else. I don't even know what people are eating anymore, but they love this stuff. The big food companies certainly get some credit or blame for producing all this stuff. But the fact is they're producing what people want, at least, you know, under the current system. Maybe if everybody was using Bitcoin, it wouldn't be that way. But we are human beings. We evolved a certain way where in which these kind of foods, the certain combinations of, you know, grain, sugar and fat light up our brains, give us dopamine hits that people like and become addicted to. So it's a tough problem. You know, people have to care about themselves individually to avoid this, in my opinion.
I mean, they're literally engineering the food to be as addictive as possible to set up this dopamine.
Exactly. An addictive product is obviously going to be the most profitable product because people are going to come back for more and more every time, right? So that's what they want to do.
Yeah. No, but it's funny once you, I mean, I'm not perfect by any means in terms of diet. I have a slice of pizza and a donut every once in a while. I try not to eat it too often, but even like having cut a lot of that stuff out of my diet over the last many years and focused more on protein and good carbs. Once you eat that stuff again, you have like the first bite and it's like, holy crap. Like the stuff is addicting. You feel it. And then a few hours later you feel like shit. But once you remove it and then re-enter it into your diet, it's pretty startling how jarring it is once you eat it. It's like, holy shit, I can feel that sugar rush.
Absolutely. This stuff is incredible. I mean, when it's put together in the right way, what it does to you, you just want to eat more and more of it. So that's what they do, putting these particular combinations of ingredients together to just make people want to eat more and more. And yeah, when you get away from it, it becomes stark when you taste that stuff again, how jolting it is to you.
Yeah. And I'm thinking, I'm looking at, I'm like a nice coffee here with a little bit of half and half. I'm thinking of like people going to Starbucks. That's one thing. I don't go to Starbucks often, but when I go there and I just get like a black coffee that I then go put half and half in at the little station that they have, I get infuriated having to wait 10 minutes for people who are getting like frappuccinos, like with like 10 pumps of sugar and other types of creams in it. It's like, holy crap. I can't believe people are not only eating this, but spending like $15 to poison themselves multiple times a day.
I know. I totally agree. It's incredible. The amount of money they spend there. And then, I mean, as somebody said, Starbucks is, a candy store described as a coffee shop. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then you think about like going back to like money and finances, this is a large fiscal strain on the country as well. When you consider all the medical expenses that this builds up in the long term, not leading a healthy life. And then you aggregate that across the population, which 80% is either obese or overweight. That's scary to think about, like how big those costs are going to be. And you're talking about a government with $34.5 trillion of debt already. We're issuing the same amount of debt today that we were right at the onset of the COVID lockdowns. And like when you actually think about being able to sustain these costs in the long run, like it's not only unsustainable from a health perspective, we're going to have a nation that is extremely unhealthy. And I believe we're seeing that life expectancy, it's beginning to drop in the US. I think obesity is playing a part in that, but just from a monetary perspective, being able to actually afford being this unhealthy, it seems untenable.
I totally agree. And we're all paying for it with, you know, health insurance and, you know, the government programs, government health insurance, government health programs like Medicare, for example. Yeah, we're all paying for it. Definitely huge problem. And the sad part of that is so much of it could be fixed. Diabetes, for example, type 2 diabetes, the amount of money that's spent on that in this country annually is just incredible. Just billions and billions. I don't have the exact figures at hand, but anyway, tens of billions. And type 2 diabetes can fairly readily be reversed if people want to do it. But mainstream health organizations like the American Diabetes Association don't acknowledge that it can be reversed. And then, they don't acknowledge it, but maybe they don't even know how, although there's enough evidence that now that they should know how. And then, but then also you get into this whole thing about people don't want to do it. People don't want to give up the things they're eating. People don't want to exercise. I say people, I mean a lot of people, maybe the majority. Yes, a lot of this could be fixed with the will to do it, but the will isn't there, at least right now.
Well, if it's not there from the individuals, the patients, consumers, at the end of the day, do you have any hopes that a move in the other direction towards a more healthy lifestyle for most Americans can be driven by the medical community? Like, are you seeing doctors waking up to the fact that a lot of their patients are chronically unhealthy due to a lot of the advice that has been given from the medical community over the last few decades? Or do you think the incentives put forth by the pharmaceutical industrial complex are too strong to fight against?
Well, I think both of those things are going on. I do see some doctors that are very well aware of the problem, but from what I see, the vast majority of doctors are basically working long hours. They no longer have independent practices. Most of them, they're working for corporations or, you know, some kind of medical corporation. There are all kinds of medical guidelines that cover everything they do. In other words, standard of care. And so a lot of doctors have their hands tied. They might only spend an average of 10 minutes with each patient. There's only so much you can do there. So yeah, the incentives are really not there for a great change, in my opinion. It's going to take a lot more to get this done, to solve this problem.
And to wrap up and really drive it home, how could taking control of your health, whether it's in your 30s, like me, 40s, 50s, 60s, like what can that do on the back end of your life? Like how long do you think, one way to frame it is like, how long do you think getting healthy can extend your life? The other way is like, how many years does being unhealthy take off your life?
Well, a lot. So, if there are five basic things that people should do. So these are things that are really just about anybody with any awareness knows, right? So normal body weight, exercise regularly, healthy diet, don't smoke, moderate alcohol intake. People are doing those five things, the average life expectancy is around 90. So then, you know, if we're talking about really, okay, what is a healthy diet? Really getting the healthiest diet. What's the optimal amount of exercise? You know, what is the optimal body weight? All these kind of things. Then we could conceivably be talking a lot more than that. Whereas the average life expectancy in this country is, I mean, for a man is, I don't know what it is now. It's gone down 75, something like that. So the potential is huge. When you're talking about population wide, the average person living another 15 years beyond what they live now. Yeah, it's pretty big.
Yeah. You should want to. You should want to live longer, especially if you have family. You want to see your grandkids, maybe have some great grandkids down the line, pass on some wisdom. Yeah, it seems like we've gotten, and it doesn't seem like it's, I think it's objectively true that we've gotten very complacent and people are dying earlier because of that. And that actually, again, has knock on negative externalities for families at the end of the day. That's the other thing. I want to be healthy long into my 60s, 70s, hopefully have some grandchildren and be able to run around and actually take care of them. Because that's what I think needs to come back to looking at the state of the older generations in this country. Sort of force them in a home and just let them live out their later years in these homes where they don't really get as much fulfillment as they arguably should. I think the way the economic and financial system's going, I don't think that we're going to be afforded that luxury in the long term. I think we're going to have multi-generation housing. It's going to be a necessity just via the economic conditions that will exist in the country. If that's the case, like, the older people need to be in good shape to be able to help out with the young, the grandchildren, the great-grandchildren, whatever it may be. Sorry, weird rant there, but that's one of the ideas that I think is something that people should be thinking about, because I do think it's going to be a reality at some point in the next couple decades. Take care of the old people. The old people need to take care of themselves.
Absolutely.
Sorry if I sound like a crazy generationist right now, or ageist, if you will.
No, you know, the thing is that what people expect as they get older is to be in ill health. And that is the norm. People have all kinds of chronic diseases. Basically, people start getting chronic diseases starting in middle age, and then it's all decline from there until whenever it is that they die. The ideal here would be to stay healthy until very shortly before somebody dies. And that is possible. There are people, very old people, who have no chronic diseases. And then, you know, one day when they're, you know, they're very old and their time is up. But there's there's absolutely no necessity for having chronic diseases just because somebody is old. There's plenty of research that supports this, that most of what we think of as age-related diseases are really driven by excess body fat, not exercising enough, you know, various other things that can all be fixed. And so people do not need to live that way just because they're getting older.
Yeah, that's encouraging. It's good to hear, because that is what people expect. And then if you get to that point of chronic disease later in life, you think, you know, some people just tap out and be like, all right, I'm destined to slowly decline from here. That's why I really have been enjoying following you for many years now on Twitter, because I think the message that you put out there and the examples, the case studies of people that you've helped really take control of their health later in life is important. People need that positive reinforcement of, no, this is possible. You don't have to believe that you are destined to have your health decline steadily until you hit the grave. Like, you can take control. You have some agency. You can do this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. There's so much to be done. There's absolutely no reason to be sick just because you're old. And, you know, hopefully I'm providing a little bit of example for that. You know, I'm 69 and I'm doing pretty good here. So, and I plan to stay that way. You can be definitely in good health as you get older.
I think you may be the youngest looking 69-year-old that's ever been on this podcast. we've had a few too. It's goals. Young man, 32, less than half your age. I would like to look like I'm in my 50s when I'm 69.
If I only can figure out how to get rid of the gray hair.
That's good. You want the gray hair. It's it imbues wisdom. You come off very wise, which I think you are, figuring out how to be healthy later in life. I think it's important. I think, as I've said many times, something needs to change, particularly in this country, where we're just not morbidly obese and complacent from a health perspective. And I think the message that you're putting out there and the red pill that many people are taking, being like, hey, maybe I should take care of my health. Maybe taking a pill for everything or a shot for everything isn't the best way. And maybe this will actually increase my well-being, and not only from a physical standpoint, from a mental standpoint as well, which is like health is wealth at the end of the day. And wealth is not always measured in dollars.
Absolutely.
The quality of life, the quality of your experience of this world.
Yeah, absolutely. Health is wealth.
It is. Dennis, we did this on short notice. We DM'd on Friday. I said, you know what? I've been following you on Twitter for a few years now. I'd love to have you on the show. And I'm very happy that I reached out on Friday, because thoroughly enjoyed this. Again, I think the message that you're putting out there, the example that you're setting, is important. I hope anybody who's listening to this, who, you don't even have to be older, you can be in your 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, take control.
Absolutely. And yeah, I'm glad we connected too. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to do it again at some point in the future. This was, maybe we can talk about more about Bitcoin too at some point, because I know.
Okay. All right. Great.
All right. That's all we got today, freaks. Peace and love. Thank you.